You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Cleveland, Ohio, 2006. After a chance encounter, three people soon find out that life can sometimes thrust us into the public eye, even when taking great measures to avoid it. Cooper Madison was the best pitcher in baseball after being drafted number one overall in 1996 from the small Gulf Coast town of Pass Christian, Mississippi. 1 year after announcing his sudden and shocking retirement, he finds himself seeking anonymity in Cleveland, Ohio. Kara Knox is the youngest sibling to three older brothers. After a tragic work accident to her closest relative, she has built up a tough exterior as she begins her final year of college at Cleveland State University. Jason Knox, Kara's oldest brother, is the lead detective on Cleveland's Edgewater Park killer case. After months without a suspect, he's feeling the heat from his media-hungry chief. Serendipity intervenes, and all three learn that perception and reality are paths that rarely ever intersect. Before We Ever Spoke by Dan Largent. Hey folks, you really ought to check out Patricia Gillum's Heroes of Corvus series. Book one is called A Superhero's Duty, a fight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of three innocent civilians and orphaning a six-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the death of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city are not out of danger. A Superhero's Duty, Book 1 of the Heroes of Corvus by Patricia Gillum. Get this series now. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Ruth Hogan on the show with me today. She has a phenomenal new book. It's called Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel, and you probably know Ruth from her previous book, The Keeper of Lost Things. which, you know, has just captured so many people's imagination. Welcome to the show today, Ruth.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
It's great to have you, Ruth. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
I think I always write. Right from when I was tiny, I was always writing stories. And I think it came from the fact that I love to read. My parents were both great readers, and they taught me to read before I went to school. And as soon as I understood the magic of books and storytelling, I wanted to do it. It was something that I wanted to do. So I was always writing little stories and making up little stories right from as young as I can remember.
You said your parents were great readers, and this was something that was just kind of part of the atmosphere of the way you grew up. Is that right? Just books were everywhere.
I was very lucky. I grew up in a house full of books. My mum worked in a bookshop, and she said it was like feeding my habit the whole time, because I got through books so quickly. And I used to walk around, even when I was walking, I would be reading. There would be a book kind of 2 inches from my nose. So I was completely addicted. But also, I was very lucky in that my parents used to read us bedtime stories. And I think that's so important when you're little, is that you get used to hearing stories being told. And my dad used to read us stories, and he would do all the voices and the characters and really make it magical. So I think it started from a really young age with me.
One of my one of the things that has kind of touched me more deeply than anything lately is my our kids were in our bedroom last night as everyone was getting ready to go to bed, and my son, my youngest son, who's about to be 16 in just a few weeks, said, "Dad, I remember when you would come in our bedroom every night and make up these stories and do all the voices and all that." And he said that meant so much to me. And it just, you know, that having, carrying on this tradition of telling stories and passing down, you know, that's just some of the best things ever.
It's really precious. And it's not just about the stories. It's about spending time with your family and, you know, kids spending time with their parents. And it's such a precious thing, and it doesn't last that long. So you need to make the most of it while it's there.
Do you remember, Ruth, what the first book or story, or maybe it was an author, the first time that you read something that made you immediately want to tell a story of your own, or maybe continue the story that you read, or just the just sparked for you?
I think as an adult, the book that I read that made me want to be a writer is it's interesting because it's not a particularly well-known book, and it's quite short, and it's called Mornings at Seven by a guy called Eric Malpass. And it's just a very cozy story about a family who live in the English countryside. But the first line of that book is dawn and a cold porridge sky. That's the opening line. And it has stayed with me forever, because as soon as I read it, I could see what kind of sky he was talking about. And his writing just pulled me in, and I knew who this family were. And I wanted to go and live there, and I wanted to go and spend time with them. And for me, that's the magic of a really good book. If it can pull you in to the world and make you want to go and live there while you're reading it, then the writer's job is done. And that was the first book that I read that actually did that to me. It really pulled me in and made me think, I know these people, and I really care about what happens to them. I can see where they live. And obviously I didn't know them, but it had that effect on me, and it was just magical, absolutely magical.
What an evocative first line. That's I'm a big fan of first lines, first pages, first chapters of books.
Yeah.
That is so crucial because if you don't set that tone from the beginning, you know, you're doing the reader a big disservice. And I'm thinking, as I'm saying that, I've read books that are kind of slow burns, and you have to really get into it before it starts building. And that's, you know, there's a place for that, but man, there's just something about, someone who can set an entire scene with one sentence that gets me fired up. I love that.
I always describe it as the hook. If you can hook somebody in the first couple of lines, if you can hook them in, then you're onto a winner, because they want to find out what happens in the rest of the book. And I think also as well, we've turned into a society. I mean, it's not true at the moment because we're all on lockdown, so the whole world has changed. But we want something quickly, and so we've got so much choice. And I get sent loads of books to read now, loads of pre-publication books, and I don't have time to read all of them. So there has to be something in those initial pages that pulls me in and makes me want to find out what happens in the rest of the book. And I do think it's really important. You've got to make sure that you grab your reader very early on.
Right. Ruth, do you believe that storytellers are born, or can a storyteller be made?
That's such a brilliant question. I never usually pay a great deal of attention to those lists. You know that they have those lists, you know, 20 tips to be a good writer and 20 things you shouldn't wear after you're 50 and all those lists. I never read them. But there was one by a writer called P.D. James. I'm sure it was P.D. James, and I really like her work. And I'm going to nick what she said in answer to your question, because basically what she said is, you're either born a writer or you're not. You can teach somebody to write competently in the same way that you can teach someone to play the piano competently, but you can't teach someone to be musical. They either are musical or they're not. And you can teach them to play the piano very well, but there'll always be that element that you can't teach. And I think it's the same for writers and great storytellers. I think you can practice and you can go on courses and you can learn all the academic stuff, but there has to be that little something, and I don't know what it is, but there's that little sprinkling of magic that has to be there from the beginning. And the other thing I would say, and again, I'm stealing this from my UK publisher, because she's been asked this question so many times when I've been doing events with her, and she said, the thing about a true writer is they have to write. It's not a choice, and it's not something that they quite like doing. It's something that they have to do. It's a compulsion. You know, their life is not complete unless they're writing. And that's certainly how I feel. I get very, when I'm not actually working on something, I get quite anxious. So for me, writing is a kind of, it's a sanctuary. It's a relaxation, if you like.
Well, and I think we've heard stories of writers that relationship with writing was not always a pleasant experience. The have to, the drive, you know, was something that they wrestled with. I love it when you know, when I get to talk to a writer who loves the process, and but it's not that way for everyone, and I feel sorry for people that struggle with the desire so much.
I mean, you can enjoy the struggle. I'm not saying it's always easy, because this sounds contradictory, but if I'm in the middle of writing something, it will keep me awake at night. It will wake me up at night. It does. It's like having someone tapping you on the shoulder all the time. You can't get away from it. And so it's a kind of a weird relationship, and I love it because it's something I love to do, but it's not always easy. And sometimes you think, oh, could you just give me a break for a couple of hours? But it won't, because it's in your head and those characters are in your head and they want to be written about and they want to be on the page. So it's not always an easy relationship in that sense, in that if you're fully committed to it, there is no time off. And I always say that the thing about being a writer is you never actually truly get any time off, because in your head you're always writing, or you're thinking about writing, or you're thinking about a character.
It's not a job that you can punch the time card and go home for the day. It's the voices are always in your head.
Always, yeah. Right. But then we have to be grateful for that, because if they weren't there, we'd be in real trouble.
Yes, we would. Yes, we would. Ruth, like so many writers that I've talked with, you know, we're kind of born with this desire. We go through life chasing stories. And a lot of us, that desire to write, you know, that great novel, don't get the opportunity to just, you know, immediately pursue that as a career. Most of us, you know, have to deal with life in the interim, and we've got to pay bills and mortgages and raise children and all of that sort of things. But writing has a way of coming back around and drawing us back in. The first book that you published was The Keeper of Lost Things. Was that the first novel that you had written?
I'd kind of written half novels before. I mean, I had written versions of things, but I think that was the first complete novel that I'd written. It was the one that I thought, yes, this is actually a proper book and it's finished and I'm proud of it and I'm happy to send this out to people now.
Do you remember the kernel, that first idea that birthed The Keeper of Lost Things?
Very clearly, because I was actually on a train, and the first line of the book is about some human cremation remains in a biscuit tin, which sounds quite weird if you haven't read the book, but trust me, it makes sense. And this line just came to me about this biscuit tin on a train. So I had the first line, because we were talking about hooks earlier, and bizarrely, I got this first line. And then it took me a little while for the other elements to come along to complete the story. But I describe myself as being a documentary junkie. I love documentaries, and the weirder they are, the better. And I'm also one of those horrible people who tears articles out of magazines and newspapers. Anything that catches my eye or fires my imagination. And there were two documentaries that sparked Keeper of Lost Things. And one was about the weird stuff that ends up in lost property departments. And the other one was about what happens to human cremation remains when they're not collected from funeral directors. So it was those two things. And then the third element was the story of an old neighbour of mine who, I used to live in this little cul-de-sac of cottages. And I didn't know this guy. He was really old, and he used to go past my kitchen window with a bike with a massive basket on the front of it. And he always had stuff in the basket, and I was always wondering what he was doing with it. And one day he pushed his bike past my kitchen window, and it had a massive stone sink in the basket. And I was really worried, because he was really skinny, this guy, and I thought, if that falls on him, he's dead. He's going to be crushed under the sink. So I ran out to help him. And after that, I kind of got to know him a little bit, not terribly well, but just enough to say hello to and to send some soup round or a piece of cake or whatever. And when he died, I discovered that his entire house was full of stuff. And he was an extreme hoarder, and he had filled his whole house, all his outbuildings, everything. And it was just a complete mixture. Some of it was rubbish, some of it was old newspapers, some of it was antiques. And one of my other neighbours told me that he had been a professional man, and he'd been engaged to be married, and his fiancée had died suddenly before they got married. And I just kind of wrote this own narrative in my head about what happened with him. And I felt like he tried to fill the gap that she left with things, and it never filled the gap. So he just kept adding more things and adding more things and adding more things, even though there was no rhyme or reason to it. It was like there was this huge void in his life. And that was the only way he could think of trying to fill it. So that they were the three kind of ideas that came together to set me off writing the story.
Ruth, your books are full of some of the most vibrant three-dimensional characters of just about any writer I can think of.
Thank you. That's lovely.
It's true. Do the characters come to you fully formed? You mentioned a character or two that that have given you ideas, but as you know, Anthony Perdue, for instance, in The Keeper of Lost Things, did he, you know, when he showed up on the scene, was he fully formed? How do characters start communicating to you who they are and what they're about?
My novels are very character driven, and I usually start off with a cast of characters. And in terms of the book, I know the beginning, I know the end, and I know my cast of characters. Although they kind of, it's difficult to describe, they kind of arrive fully formed, but I don't always know what they're going to do. And it's really interesting because I've just finished work on my fourth novel, and I had an idea in my head about the way that two characters would behave. And then once I started writing about them, they did something completely different. And as a writer, for me, that's really exciting. But it's also quite scary because you start off thinking, I know where I'm going with this. I know exactly where I'm going. And then suddenly you don't know where you're going because they do something completely different. And with Anthony Perdue, he turned up pretty much fully formed. And I knew him and I knew what he was going to be like. But for example, in Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel, my inspiration for one of the characters in that book, the character is called Joseph Geronimo Heathcliff O'Shea. And the idea for his character came from a real guy that I met years ago. And he was a homeless man that I met while I was walking my rescue dogs. And I had a particularly new dog at the time who was a Great Dane cross, and he'd been treated really badly. And so I was quite wary about him meeting new people because he was scared and he was a big guy, this dog. So, and I was walking him with two of my other dogs, and I came across this guy who was just sitting on a bench, and he really caught my eye because he looked amazing. He had really long, dark hair, these amazing, piercing blue eyes, very tanned skin. And this dog, my dog, just dragged me over there. And I was really worried because I thought, oh, if he doesn't know how to handle dogs, this is an issue. So I was trying to pull the dog back. The dog wasn't having any of it. And this guy just leaned down and he took my dog's head in his hands, and it was a big head, Great Dane cross. And he just put his face to this dog, and I could see my dog relax. And he just had this something about him, and I still can't put my finger on it, but there was something about this guy's personality. And he was Irish, and my dog was Irish as well. He came over from Ireland. So I think they had a connection there. And I went home and I wrote down everything I could remember about this guy's appearance and his voice and his manner, knowing full well that he would be a character in one of my books at some point. And he's in Queenie. And it's really poignant because I saw him quite a few years later, and he was in a very poor way because obviously, you know, life on the road is very tough if you are a homeless person. And I'm pretty sure he's probably not around anymore. But I like to think, I would love wherever he is, that he knows that he's in my book. And that's my tribute to him, because he gave me the gift of the character. And I have no idea if I've answered your question now, because I just go off a massive tangent.
I love that. I love that answer. That was a perfect answer. Ruth, the idea of ghosts, are something that pop up from time to time in your writing, not overt, but there's this idea of the ethereal there's a nod to that in your writing and in your characters. What is that about? And is that what do ghosts symbolize for you?
Well, this really comes from my dad, because he has an Irish background. He was very artistic. He was very into storytelling and that kind of thing. And he always used to talk about ghosts in a very matter-of-fact way. When he was young, he was brought up in a house that was haunted. And then when he was a teenager, they moved to another house and that was haunted. So he always spoke to me about those things in a very matter-of-fact way. Not at all sensationalized, yes, it was haunted, and yes, why shouldn't people who died find a way of communicating with people that are still here? So I was brought up with that not being a weird thing, but also not being a big deal, just being, you know, part of life. And so I think I include it in my writing in that way. I don't expect my readers to believe in ghosts. I ask them to accept the possibility that they could exist, because we can't prove otherwise. I've had experiences that I can't explain. I would never say to people, you must believe in ghosts because there is such a thing. All I would say is that in my experience, I've seen things and heard things that I can't explain. And I think we get quite scared if we can't explain things. We like to have a label for things. We like to have a scientific explanation for things. But I think we should all know now that the world is a huge and amazing place, and there is so much stuff that goes on that we can't explain. But I don't think that ghosts are such a weird thing. It's the name, I think. When you say ghost, people get really kind of, ooh. Whatever you want to call it, there are things in this world that we can't explain. And I like to explore those as a writer.
Well, and as writers, it's such a I don't understand people that completely dismiss any idea of a ghost or folks that have passed on that could still communicate. Yet we'll talk about the voices in our head, and we'll talk about characters as if they're real people, and we don't think that's weird at all.
No, I know.
It's
and
so
also
funny.
The other thing that always makes me laugh is occasionally readers will contact you and say, well, I really liked your book apart from the ghosts. And that's just ridiculous, because obviously that's not true. And I'm always really tempted to say, but it's fiction.
Right.
I'm writing fiction. You know, I mean, some of it's based on real life, but it's actually made up. This hasn't actually happened.
Yeah, it's not a how-to book. It's a novel. Oh, man. Well, Ruth, let's talk about Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel, your brand new book, out everywhere now when people are hearing this, and there's links to it in the show notes of this episode. This book is once again full of characters that are larger than life and that just get right, hit you in the heart. Tell me about Tilly. Who is she? Where did she come from? And did this book begin with her, or what's the genesis of Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel?
Again, I think it was a cast of characters that just came together and said, you have to write about us. But also, it's set in Brighton, which was very important to me. I wanted to write a book that was set in Brighton. But it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because I needed somewhere for my characters to be at home. And because they're how I would describe them as being slightly cracked in the kiln. So they're slightly quirky, slightly unusual. And Brighton's a good place for that because it's the kind of place where differences are celebrated. They're not just tolerated, they're actually celebrated. And so it was the perfect home for my characters, really. But Tilly, I had tremendous fun writing Tilly, because I was able to draw on a lot of my own childhood memories and experiences. Things like travelling on the bus, There's a scene where she has a competition with an old guy on the bus. She's sitting opposite him and they have a competition pulling faces. And that's something that I used to do with my granddad. So so that was something that I was able to, and just sitting on the bus, just sitting on those old English buses with the prickly velvet seats and going shopping with my mum, which was a very different experience when I was a kid because I'm really old. And, you know, we didn't have supermarkets and stuff like that. It was, you know, it was like a corner shop and everyone used to go there and used to shop two or three times a week. It wasn't like you went and did a big shop once a week. So it was great, and I was able to draw on those memories. But also in Tilly's darker moments, she has difficult moments in her relationship with her mum. And that was similar for me because I think one of the things about Tilly's mum in the book is that she is frustrated with her life. She's bright and she describes herself as wanting a bigger life than the life that she's got. She feels that she's underachieved. And that was something that I think was something my own mum felt very strongly. And, you know, she was very bright and she was very clever and she wanted to continue with her education. But unfortunately, she came from a generation and a class where boys continued with their education and girls didn't, because very often families had to choose, you know, who could they continue to support in their education. And my mum had a brother and he was allowed to continue and she wasn't. And she left school at 16 and she went to work in a local manufacturing company. And I think she found it really tough. She did all the things that were expected of her. She got married. She had two children. But she never used that intellectual side of her brain. And that was the thing that I think she found really, really frustrating. Excuse me. And she ended up, like Tilly's mum in the book, she actually ended up in a psychiatric hospital for a brief period. She had electric convulsive therapy. And I remember her telling me about these things in a very matter-of-fact way. But they had a huge impact on her life. And they also had a big impact on my life, because I remember going to visit mum in the psychiatric hospital. And I could have only been maybe six, not very old at all. And recently, my parents both went into residential care. My mum's got Alzheimer's now. And I found a letter that she wrote to us. She wrote to me and my sister when she was actually in the psychiatric hospital. So all of these things informed writing Tilly. So there's the dark side and the light side. But actually, it was quite cathartic to write about it, but it was also great fun. Because Tilly is also a very, she bounces back and she's got this real kind of sense of humour and she's very curious about the world. She's very curious about adults because, and this is again something I remember from my own childhood, adults do, why do they do that weird thing of using different words and kind of whispering and talking in front of kids and thinking that kids aren't understanding what they're saying? When in fact, by doing that, kids are going, they're talking about something that they don't want us to understand. And we actually don't understand it. And I remember as a kid, I would go away and make stuff up because I would hear what they were talking about. And I think they're talking about this, and go away and repeat it. So, you know, it's not, parents out there, don't talk in code in front of your kids because they'll just make up something far worse and go away and tell everyone about it. Yeah, so that was Tilly. She was really fun to write about.
I connected with Tilly in a very visceral way. As I'm reading this, I could see myself in her. I mean, just precocious, larger than life. You know, loved everything about life. And then, you know, things happened to her, and like you, you know, said, she comes up with her own story to deal with the things that happened to her. And to her, they're very real. And, you know, there's some truth. But, you know, as always, when we're dealing with other people, the truth is much bigger than what we make it out to be. I lost both of my parents in the past year, and you know, it's a very strange thing when you start peeling back the layers of someone else's life, and all of the opinions that you had formed of them, good and bad, are rarely everything that you thought they were. And you know, when at the end of someone's life, and you start going through all of their things, and you start uncovering, you know, pieces of the puzzle that were never available to you, you know, but when they were alive, you start getting a much fuller picture of who this person was, aside from who your experience with this person was. And this book, I mean, it just hit me in such a real visceral way, that I could completely connect with Tilly and understand, her plight. When you're writing adult, Tilda, what were some of the things that were going through your mind in helping her deal with her expectations of what happened to her?
Partly what you've just said is the fact that when you grow up, you do see your parents in a different light, but sometimes you need someone else to say to you, your vision of this person is slightly blinkered. And there's a character called Penelope, who actually talks to the grown-up Tilda, because she knows Tilda's mother as an adult, and she kind of nudges her and says, actually, your mum, there was more to her than you knew. And I think sometimes it's that thing of getting a different perspective, and retrospectively for me, I mean, my dad actually died a month ago. And we had his funeral this week in very difficult circumstances because of the coronavirus. Very, very difficult. Thank you. But exactly the same thing happened to me, in that so many people have contacted me in the past 2 or 3 weeks telling me what they knew about Dad and how they saw him. And it adds so many different layers, because obviously he was my dad. That's who he was to me, but he was so many other things as well. And the number of people who said he was such a brilliant neighbor, he was such a good friend, he touched so many people's lives. And I'm only now getting to learn about that because so many people have contacted me, and it does give this different perspective. But the other thing about Tilda, as an adult, is that she deals with OCD. And that's something that I have. And I can trace that directly back to some childhood experiences. And I was able to use that with Tilda, because it's a way of controlling her life. It's a way of saying, well, I can't control this part of my life, but I'm going to control it by lining my things up on a shelf and making sure that they don't move. And so it was interesting writing about her and tracing that through from when she was little. But the nice thing about writing Tilda as the adult is actually she becomes more like Tilly as she progresses on this journey through the book. She actually remembers what it's like to be Tilly, and she rediscovers some of that spontaneity and some of that joy in life around her, and actually, you know, re-engaging with people. So she goes on this journey from child to adult, but then she gets some of that childishness back.
One of the best things about your books are the collection of kind of oddball characters. these characters that are so much fun. And, you know, I find myself connecting these characters with people that I know and people that have been, you know, in my life from time to time. And they just leave such an indelible mark, on our imaginations. What is it about oddball characters that you love so much?
I think I said to you earlier, I hate those lists. I hate those lists that they put in magazines and Sunday supplements saying 10 things you shouldn't wear after you're 50, and, you know, what women shouldn't wear after they get to a certain age. And so I like rebellious characters. I like people who live life on their own terms. And there's a guy called Ari Seth Cohen, who's an American photographer. I don't know whether you've heard of him. He's got a massive following on Instagram and stuff. And he photographs men and women of a certain age, usually sort of over 70, over 80, who just rock it in terms of what they wear. They, you know, they really have style. They do what they like. There's one lady who has amazing orange eyelashes that are about an inch long, and she wears them every day. And I guess with some of these characters, I'm kind of writing a blueprint for my own old age, because I hate this idea that age, that, you know, fashion and enjoying yourself and being completely wacky stops when you get to a certain age. I think, if anything, you should get more out there as you get older. You should make the most of it because you've got the confidence to do it. And so this is why I like writing about those characters. And there was one lady that Ari Seth Cohen photographed, and she particularly came to my attention because she and I share the same name. And she was also called Ruth. And Ruth, at the time he photographed her, I think she was 101. And she still got up every day and put on a full face of makeup, put her best outfits on. And she also worked out with little mini dumbbells every day to make sure that her arms kept strength. And he said to her, "Why do you do this?" And she said, "Because you never know who you're going to meet on the way to the mailbox." And I just thought, yes, see, that's the kind of attitude that you should have, is, you know, never say never, just keep living life with your pants on fire. You know, take everything that you can get out of life and squeeze everything out of it, because you just never know how long you're here for.
Absolutely. Ruth, I love this book so much. I'm recommending it to everyone. And
oh, thank you so much. That's really kind.
Well, and you know that we're all in this weird time together where we're, you know, that there's so much we don't know about the future, and there's, you know, we're having a lot of time to sit and get to know ourselves and our family. And, I think this is the perfect time for a book like Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. Ruth, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Yes. I'm on Twitter as Ruth Marie Hogan, and I'm also on Instagram as Ruth Marie Hogan. And I'm also on Facebook. I think I'm Ruth Marie Hogan on Facebook. 100% sure. But definitely on Twitter and Instagram. And I post a lot on Twitter and Instagram. So
great. We'll put links to all of those places where people can find you in the show notes of this episode. Queenie Malone's Paradise Hotel, out, available everywhere now in Kindle edition, audiobook, and hardcover. Ruth, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We could go on for hours.
I know.